against flares. To compensate, Sven had always given me double doses of the dirtiest and lowliest jobs of our squad to quell any rumblings about my favored status. From mucking the stables to shining his boots to loading and carrying the dead off the field. I'd never seen resentment in my fellow soldiers' faces or heard it on their lips, but I had seen plenty of their pity. An untried soldier, no matter how expertly trained, was no soldier at all. Sven mounted his horse and rode alongside me. I knew he wouldn't come far. As much as he blustered about my plans, because he was bound by duty to do just that, he was also obligated by the strong bond we had forged through our years together. "How will I know where you are?" "You won't." "Now that's a thought, isn't it?" "And what shall I tell your parents?" "Tell them I've gone off to the hunting lodge to sulk for the summer. They should like that. A nice, safe haven."
"The whole summer?"
"We'll see."
"Something could happen."
"Yes, it could. I hope it does. You're not making your case any better, you know." I watched him out of the corner of my eye, surveying my gear, a sign he was truly resigned to my vanishing into the unknown. If I weren't heir to the throne, he wouldn't have given it a second thought. He knew he had prepared me for the worst and the unexpected. My skills, at least in training exercises, had been well proved. He grunted, signaling his reluctant approval. Ahead was a narrow ravine where two horses could no longer ride abreast, and I knew that would be his point of departure. The day was already wearing thin.
"Will you confront her?"
"No. I probably won't even speak to her."
"Good. Better that you don't. If you do, watch your R's and L's. It will peg your region."
"Already noted," I said to assure him I'd thought of everything, but that detail had escaped me.
"If you need to send me a message, write it in the old tongue in case it's intercepted."
"I won't be sending any messages."
"Whatever you do, don't tell her who you are. A Dalbrek head of state intervening on Morrigan's soil could be construed as an act of war."
"You mistake me for my father, Sven. I'm not a head of state."
"You're heir to the throne and your father's representative. Don't make matters worse for Dalbrek or your fellow soldiers."
We rode silently. Why was I going? What was the point if I wasn't going to bring her back or even speak to her? I knew these thoughts were spinning in Sven's head, but it wasn't what he imagined. I wasn't angry because she'd thought of bolting before I did. I'd thought of it long ago, when the marriage was first proposed by my father. But he had convinced me the union was for the good of Dalbrek, and everyone would look the other way if I chose to take a mistress after the marriage. I was angry because she'd had the courage to do what I hadn't. Who was this girl who thumbed her nose at two kingdoms and did as she pleased? I wanted to know. As we neared the ravine, Sven broke the silence.
"It's the note, isn't it?"
A month before the wedding, Sven had delivered a note to me from the princess. A secret note. It was still sealed when Sven handed it to me. His eyes had never seen the contents. I had read it and ignored it. I probably shouldn't have. "No, I'm not going because of a note." I gave a short tug on the reins and stopped, turning to face him. "You do know, Sven, this isn't really about Princess Arabella." He nodded. It had been a long time coming. He reached out and patted my shoulder, and then turned his horse back toward Dalbrek without another word. I continued down the ravine, but after a few miles, I reached into my vest and pulled the note from the inner pocket. I looked at the hastily scrawled letters, not exactly a royal missive. "I should like to inspect you before our wedding day." I tucked the note back into my pocket. And so she shall.
There is one true history and one true future. Listen well. For the child sprung from misery will be the one to bring hope. From the weakest will come strength. From the hunted will come freedom. Song of Venda. Chapter 4. The Assassin.
I'd gladly do it myself, but I need to return to my duties in Venda. You'll be in and out in a day. She's only a royal, after all. You know how they are. And only 17 at that. How hard could it be to find her? I had smiled at the Komazar's summation of royals, but an answer wasn't necessary. We both knew it would be easy. A panicked prey doesn't worry about leaving a messy trail. The Komazar had done my job many times. He was the one who had trained me.
If it will be easy, why can't I go?
Eben had complained. This job is not for you, I had told him. Eben was eager to prove himself. He was skilled with both their language and a knife, and being small and barely 12, he could pass for a child, especially with his mournful brown eyes and cherub face, which had the advantage of disarming suspicions. But there was a difference between killing in battle and slitting a girl's throat as she slept. He wasn't ready for it. He might hesitate when he saw her startled eyes. That was the hardest moment, and there could be no hesitation, no second chances. The Komazar had made that clear. An alliance between Morrigan and Dalbrek could make all of our efforts futile. Even worse, the girl is said to be a Ciara. We may not believe in such magical thinking, but others do, and it might embolden them or make our own people fearful. We can't take a chance. Her flight is their bad luck and our good fortune. Slip in, slip out. Your specialty. And if you can make it look like the work of Dalbrek, so much the better. I know you'll fulfill your duties. You always do. Yes, I always met my duty. Far ahead the trail forked, and Eben saw that as his last chance to resume his campaign.
I still don't see why I shouldn't be the one to go. I know the language just as well as you.
And all the dialects of Morrigan as well? I questioned. Before he could answer, Grizz reached out and cuffed the side of his head. Eben yelped, sending a round of guffaws through the other men.
The Komazar wants him to do the deed, not you, he shouted. Quit your whining!
Eben was silent for the remainder of the ride. We reached the point where our paths diverged. Grizz and his band of three had their own special skills. They would weave their way through the northernmost portion of Morrigan, where the kingdom had foolishly concentrated its forces. They'd be creating their own special brand of mayhem, not as bloody as mine, but just as productive. Their work would take considerably longer, though, which meant I'd have a holiday, as Grizz described it, while I waited for them at a designated camp in the Camlanteau for our return trip to Venda. He knew as well as I did that the Camlanteau was no holiday. I watched as they went their own way, Eben sulking low in his saddle. Not a job for you. Had I been that eager to please the Komazar when I was Eben's age? Yes. It was just a handful of years past, but it seemed like two lifetimes ago. The Komazar wasn't even a dozen years older than I was, hardly a full-grown man himself when he became ruler of Venda. That was when he took me under his wing. He saved me from starving, saved me from a lot of things I've tried to forget. He gave me what my own kind hadn't, a chance. I've never stopped paying him back. There are some things you can never pay back. But this would be a first even for me. Not that I hadn't slit throats in the dark of night before, but those throats had always belonged to soldiers, traitors, or spies, and I knew their deaths meant my comrades would live. Even so, each time my blade slid across a throat, the startled eyes would steal a part of my soul. I would have cuffed Eben myself if he'd brought up the subject again. He was too young to begin losing himself. Slip in, slip out, and then on to a holiday.
They thought themselves only a step lower than the gods, proud in their power over heaven and earth. They grew strong in their knowledge, but weak in their wisdom, craving more and still more power, crushing the defenseless. Morrigan, Book of Holy Text, Volume 4. Chapter 5.
Terravin was just around the next bend. At least that was what Pauline had said a dozen times. Her excited anticipation became mine as she recognized landmarks. We passed a massive tree that had the names of lovers carved into its bark. Then, a little farther along, a half-circle of stumpy marble ruins that looked like loose, crooked teeth in an old man's mouth, and finally in the distance, a shining blue cistern crowned a hill with a court of junipers surrounding it. These signs meant we were close. It had taken us 10 days to get this far, but we would have made it sooner if we hadn't spent 2 days going out of our way to leave false leads in case my father had trackers hunting us down. Pauline had been appalled when I bundled up my costly wedding dress and threw it into a thicket of blackberry brambles, but she was positively mortified when I used my dagger to pry the jewels from my wedding cloak and then sent the mutilated remains downriver tied to a log. She made 3 signs of penance for me. If the cloak was found by anyone who recognized it, I hoped the presumption would be that I had drowned. For wishing that horrifying news on my parents, I should have paid penance of my own. But then I remembered they were not only prepared to send their only daughter away to live with a man she didn't love, but also to a kingdom they themselves didn't fully trust. I swallowed the knot in my throat and said nothing but good riddance as the cloak that my mother, my grandmother, and their mothers before them had worn floated away. We used the jewels to trade for coin at Luisa Veche, a large town about 2 hours' ride out of our way. 3 blue sapphires thrown in for the merchant if he forgot where they came from. It felt deliciously evil and exciting to trade in such a way, and as soon as we were down the road, we burst into laughter at our audacity. The merchant had looked at us as if we were thieves, but since the transaction was in his favor, he said nothing. From there, we backtracked, and a few more miles down the road, we traveled east again. On the outskirts of a small village, we stopped at a farmhouse and traded the surprised farmer our valuable ravens for 3 donkeys. We also slipped him a good amount of coin for more silence. 2 girls arriving in Terravin on grand steeds with the distinctive brand of the Morrigan stables were sure to draw attention, and that was one thing we couldn't afford. We didn't need 3 donkeys, but the farmer insisted the 3rd would be lost without the other 2, and we found he was right, as it trailed close behind without even a tug from the rope. Otto, Nove, and Dieci, the farmer had called them. I rode Otto, the largest of the 3, a big brown fellow with a white muzzle and a long mop of fur between his ears. By now, our riding clothes were so filthy from the hundreds of miles we had covered, and our soft leather boots so caked in mud, we were easy to ignore. No one would want to look upon us for long, and that was just the way I wanted it. I wouldn't have anything interfere with the dream of Terravin. I knew we were close now. It was something about the air, something about the light, something I couldn't name, but it streamed through me like a warm voice. Home. Home. Foolishness, I knew. Terravin had never been my home, but maybe it could be. On this last stretch, my gut suddenly jumped with fear that I'd hear something else, the thunder of hooves behind us. What Father's trackers would do to me was one thing, but what they might do to Pauline was another. If we were caught, I already planned that I'd tell them I had forced Pauline to help me against her will. I just had to convince Pauline to stick to that story, too, because she was nothing if not true to the core. "There! Look! Through the trees!" Pauline yelled, pointing into the distance. "The sliver of blue! That's the Bay of Terravin!" I strained but couldn't see anything except thick stands of pine, a scrabble of oak, and the grassy brown hills between them. I urged Otto on, as if such a thing could be done with an animal that only knew one speed. Then as we turned the bend, not only the bay, but the whole fishing village of Terravin came into view. It was exactly the jewel that Pauline had described. My stomach squeezed. A half-circle of aquamarine bobbed with boats of red and yellow, some with billowing white sails, others with large paddle wheels churning up the water behind them. Still others splashed a trail of foam as oars dipped at their sides. They were all so small from this distance they might have been a child's toys. But I knew people manned them, that fishermen called to each other, cheering their day's catch, the wind carrying their voices, sharing their victories, breathing their stories. On the shore where some of them headed was a long wharf with more boats, and people as small as ants moving back and forth, up and down, busy with their work. Then, maybe most beautiful of all, surrounding the bay were homes and shops that crept up the hills, each one a different color, bright blue, cherry red, orange, lilac, lime, a giant fruit bowl with the Bay of Terravin at its heart, and finally dark green fingers of forest reached down from the hills to hold the multicolored bounty in its palm. Now I understood why it had always been Pauline's dream to return to the childhood home she had been uprooted from when her mother died. She'd been sent to live with a distant aunt in the North Country, and then, when that aunt became ill, handed off to yet another aunt she didn't even know, my mother's own attendant. Pauline's life had been one of a sojourner, but at last she was back in the place of her roots, her home. It was a place I knew with one glance could be my home, too, a place where the weight of who I was supposed to be didn't exist. My joy bobbed unexpectedly. How I wish my brother Bryn were here to see this with me. He loved the sea. Pauline's voice finally broke through my thoughts. "Is something wrong? You haven't said a word. What do you think?" I looked at her, my eyes stung. "I think, if we hurry, we might be able to bathe before dinner." I slapped Otto's backside. "First dip!" Pauline was not to be outdone, and with a wild cry and prod in his ribs, she got her donkey to race ahead of mine. Our reckless license was checked as we turned onto the main thoroughfare that wove through town. We tucked our hair into our caps and pulled them low over our eyes. Terravin was small and out of the way, but not so isolated that it couldn't be a stopping point for the Royal Guard, or a tracker. But even with my chin held close to my chest, I took it all in. The wonder, the sounds, the smells, even the clap of our donkey's hooves on the red-tiled streets sounded like music. It was so different from Civica in every way. We passed a plaza shaded by a giant fig tree. Children jumped rope under its enormous umbrella, and musicians played a flute and a bandonion, puffing out cheerful tunes for townsfolk who conversed around small tables that lined the perimeter. Farther into town, merchandise spilled from stores onto neighboring walkways. A rainbow of scarves billowed in the breeze outside one shop, and at another, crates of fresh, shiny eggplant, striped squash, lacy fennel, and fat pink turnips were displayed in neat, vibrant rows. Even the tack shop was cheerfully painted in robin's egg blue. The muted tones of Civica were nowhere to be found. Here, everything sang with color. No one looked at us. We blended in with others who were passing by. We were two more workers on our way home after a long day at the docks, or maybe just tired strangers looking for a friendly inn. In our trousers and caps, we probably looked more like scrawny men. I tried to keep from smiling as I eyed the town that Pauline had described so many times. My smile vanished when I saw three royal guards approaching on horseback. Pauline spotted them too and pulled back on her reins, but I whispered a hushed command to her, "Keep going. Keep your head down." We proceeded forward, though I wasn't sure either of us breathed. The soldiers were laughing with each other, their horses moving at a leisurely pace. A cart driven by another soldier lumbered behind them. They never glanced our way, and Pauline delivered a relieved sigh after they passed. "I forgot. Dried and smoked fish. They come once a month from an eastern outpost for supplies, but mostly for fish." "Only once a month?" I whispered. "I think so." "Then our timing is good. We won't have to worry about them again for a while. Not that they'd know me anyway." Pauline took a moment to survey me and then pinched her nose. "No one would know you except perhaps the swine back home." As if on cue, Otto hawed at her remark, making us both laugh, and we raced for a warm bath. I held my breath as Pauline knocked on the small back door of the inn. It immediately swung open, but only the brief wave of a woman's arm greeted us as she rushed away and yelled over her shoulder, "Put it over there, on the block!" She was already back at a huge stone hearth, using a wooden paddle to pull flatbread from the oven. Pauline and I didn't move, which finally caught the woman's attention. "I said to..." She turned and frowned when she saw us. "Not here with my fish, eh? A couple of mumpers, I suppose." She motioned to a basket by the door. "Grab an apple and a biscuit and be on your way. Come back after the rush and I'll have some hot stew for you." Her attention was already elsewhere, and she yelled to someone who called to her from the front room of the inn. A tall, gangly boy stumbled through a swinging door with a burlap cloth in his arms, the tail of a fish wagging out the end.
"Loafhead! Where's my cod? I'm to make stew with a crappy?"
She grabbed the fish from him anyway, slapped it down on the butcher block, and with one decisive chop, whacked its head off with a cleaver. I guessed the crappy would do. So this was Birdie. Pauline's Amita, her auntie. Not a blood aunt, but the woman who had given Pauline's mother work and a roof over her head when her husband had died and the bereft widow had a small infant to feed. The fish was skillfully gutted and boned in a matter of seconds and plopped into a bubbling kettle. Pulling her apron up to wipe her hands, she looked back over at us, one eyebrow raised. She blew a salt and pepper curl from her forehead.
"You still here? I thought I told you."
Pauline shuffled forward two steps and pulled her cap from her head so that her long honey hair tumbled down around her shoulders. "Amita?" I watched the old woman's expressive face go blank. She took a step closer, squinting.
"Polly Pie?"
Pauline nodded. Birdie's arms flew open, and she swooped Pauline into her bosom. After much hugging and many half-finished sentences, Pauline finally pulled away and turned toward me. "And this is my friend Leah. I'm afraid we're both in a bit of trouble." Bertie rolled her eyes and grinned.
"Couldn't be anything that a bath and a good hot meal won't take care of."
She darted over to the swinging door, shoving it open and shouting orders.
"Gwyneth! Gone for five! Enzo will help you!"
She was already turning away before the door swung back, and I noted how, for a woman of some years who carried a hefty sampling of her own cooking around her midsection, she was spry on her feet. I heard a faint groan waft through the door from the front room and the clatter of dishes. Bertie ignored it. She led us out the back door of the kitchen.
"Loafhead. That's Enzo. He's got potential, but he's as lazy as the day is long. Takes after his shiftless father. Gwyneth and I are working on it. He'll come around. And help is hard to come by."
We followed her up some crumbling stone steps carved into the hill behind the inn, and then down a winding, leaf-littered path to a dark cottage that sat some distance away. The forest encroached just behind it. She pointed to a huge iron vat simmering on an elevated brick hearth.
"But he does manage to keep the fire going so guests can have a hot bath, and that's the first thing you two need."
As we drew closer, I heard the soft rush of water hidden somewhere in the forest behind the cottage, and I remembered the creek that Pauline had described, the banks where she had frolicked with her mother, skipping stones across its gentle waters. Bertie led us into the cottage, apologizing for the dust, explaining that the roof leaked and the room was mostly used for overflow now, which was what we were. The inn was full, and the only alternative was the barn. She lit a lantern and pulled a large copper tub that was tucked in the corner out into the middle of the room. She paused to wipe her forehead with the hem of her apron, for the first time showing any sign of exhaustion.
"Now, what kind of trouble could two young girls like you be in?"
Her gaze dropped to our middles, and she quickly added,
"It's not boy trouble, is it?"
Pauline blushed. "No, Amida, nothing like that. It's not even trouble, exactly. At least, it doesn't have to be." "Actually, the trouble is mine," I said, stepping forward and speaking for the first time. "Pauline has been helping me."
"Ah, so you have a voice after all."
"Maybe you should sit so I can..."
"You just spill it out, Leah. It is Leah, right? There's nothing I haven't heard before."
She was planted near the tub, bucket in hand, ready for a quick explanation. I decided I would give it to her. "That's right. Leah. Princess Arabella Celestine Idris Jezalia, first daughter of the House of Morrigan, to be exact." "Her Royal Highness," Pauline added meekly. "Ex-Royal Highness," I clarified. Bertie cocked her head to the side, as though she hadn't heard quite right, then paled. She reached for the bedpost and eased down onto the mattress.
"What's this all about?"
Pauline and I took turns explaining. Bertie said nothing, which I suspected was uncharacteristic of her, and I watched Pauline grow uneasy with Bertie's silence. When there was nothing left to say, I stepped closer. "We're certain no one followed us. I know a little about tracking. My brother's a trained scout in the Royal Guard. But if my presence makes you uncomfortable, I'll move on." Bertie sat for a moment longer, as if the truth of our explanation was just catching up to her, one of her brows rising in a curious, squiggled line. She stood.
"Blazing balls, yes, your presence makes me uncomfortable. But did I say anything about moving on? You'll stay right here, both of you. But I can't go giving you..."
I cut her off, already reading her thoughts. "I don't expect or want any special attention. I came here because I want a real life, and I know that includes earning my keep. Whatever work you have for me to do, I'll gladly do it." Bertie nodded.
We'll figure that part out later. For now, we need to get you two bathed and fed.
She wrinkled her nose.
In that order.
One other thing. I unbuttoned my shirt and turned around, dropping the fabric to my waist. I heard her draw in a breath as she viewed my elaborate wedding kavah. I need to get this off my back as soon as possible. I heard her step closer and then felt her fingers on my back.
Most kavahs don't last more than a few weeks, but this one, it may take a little longer.
They used the best artisans and dyes.
A good soaking bath every day will help, she offered. And I'll bring you a back brush and strong soap.
I pulled my shirt on again and thanked her. Pauline hugged her before she left, and then grabbed the bucket from the floor. You first, Your Highness. Stop! I snatched the bucket from her hand. From this day forward, there is no more Your Highness. That part of my life is gone forever. I'm only Leah now. Do you understand, Pauline? Her eyes met mine. This was it. We both understood this was the real beginning we had planned. The one we had both hoped for but weren't sure could ever be. Now it was here. She smiled and nodded. And you'll go first, I added. Pauline unpacked our few belongings while I made several trips to fill the tub with hot water. I scrubbed Pauline's back the way she had scrubbed mine so many times before. But then as she soaked, her eyes heavy with fatigue, I decided I'd go bathe in the creek so she could savor this luxury as long as she wanted. I'd never be able to pay her back for everything she had done for me. This was a small token I could offer. After meek protests, she gave me directions to the creek just a short walk behind our cottage, warning me to stay near the shallows. She said there was a small protected pool there that had the cover of thick shrubs. I promised twice to be watchful, even though she had already admitted she had never seen it anything but deserted. At the dinner hour, there was no doubt I would be alone. I found the spot, quickly stripped, and left my dirty clothes and a fresh change on the grassy bank. I shivered as I slipped below the surface of the water, but it wasn't half as cold as the streams of Sifaka. My shoulders were already warming as I broke the surface again. I drew in a deep breath, a new breath, one I had never taken before. I am only Leah now, from this day forward. It felt like a baptism, a deeper kind of cleansing. Water trickled down my face and dripped from my chin. Terevin wasn't just a new home. Dalbrek could have offered that, but there I'd have been only a curiosity in a foreign land, still with no voice in my own destiny. Terevin offered a new life. It was both exhilarating and terrifying. What if I never saw my brothers again? What if I was a failure at this life, too? But everything I had seen so far had encouraged me, even Birdie. Somehow, I'd make this new life work. The creek was wider than I expected, but I stayed in the calm shallows as Pauline had instructed. It was a clear, gentle pool no more than shoulder deep, with slick river rock dotting its bottom. I lay back and floated, my eyes resting on the filigreed canopy of oak and pine. With dusk settling, the shadows deepened. Through the trunks, golden lights began to flicker in the hillside homes as Terevin prepared for the eventide remembrances. I was surprised to find that I listened expectantly for the songs that ushered in the evening throughout all of Morrigan, but only the occasional hint of melody caught on a breeze. I will find you in the farthest corner. I paused, turning my head to the side to hear better, the burning tone of the words more urgent than any of the holy remembrances of home. I couldn't place the phrases either, but the holy text was vast. The melodies vanished, plucked away by a cool breeze, and instead I listened to the whoosh of Birdie's brush as I vigorously scrubbed my back. My left shoulder burned where soap met wedding kava, as if a battle raged between the two. With each pass of the brush, I imagined the lion crest of Dalbrek shrinking back in terror, soon to be gone from my life forever. I washed away the suds with a quick dip, then twisted around, trying to view the lion's demise, but the small section of kava I was able to see in the dim light, the vines swirling around the lion's claw on the back of my shoulder, still bloomed in all its glory. 10 days ago, I was praising the artisans. Now I wanted to curse them. Snap! I dropped down into the water and spun, ready to face an intruder. "Who's there?" I called, trying to cover myself. Only an empty forest and silence answered back. A doe, perhaps? But where had it gone so quickly? I searched the shadows of the trees, but found no movement. It was only the snap of a twig, I reassured myself. Any small animal could have made it. Or maybe a wandering guest of the inn, surprised to have come upon me? I smiled, amused that I may have frightened someone off, before they caught sight of my back, I hoped. Kavas were a sign of position and wealth, and this one, if examined too closely, clearly spoke of royalty. I stepped out of the water, hastily putting on my fresh clothes, and then spotted a small gray rabbit darting behind a tree. A relieved sigh escaped me. Only a small animal. Just as I thought.
Chapter 6.
After 3 days of keeping us in hiding, Birdie finally relaxed her tight grip, believing we were true to our word. No one had followed. She had an inn to think of, she reminded us, and couldn't afford trouble with the authorities, though I couldn't imagine anyone in a village like Taravan paying us any notice. She slowly let us venture out, running small errands for her, getting cinnamon at the Epicurean, thread at the Mercantile, and guest soaps for the inn at the soap maker. I still had some jewels left over from my wedding cloak, so I could have paid my own way as a guest. But that wasn't who I wanted to be anymore. I wanted to be engaged, attached to where I lived in the same way everyone else was, not an interloper trading on her past. The jewels remained tucked away in the cottage. Walking down to the town center felt like the days of old when my brothers and I used to run freely through the village of Civica, conspiring and laughing together, the days before my parents began limiting my activities. Now it was just me and Pauline. We grew closer. She was the sister I never had. We shared things now that protocol at Civica had made us hold back. She told me more stories of Mikhail, and the longing within me grew. I wanted what Pauline had, an enduring love that could overcome the miles and weeks that separated her from Mikhail. When she said again that he would find her, I believed it. Somehow his commitment radiated in her eyes, but there was no doubt that Pauline was worthy of such devotion. Was I? "Is he the first boy you ever kissed?" I asked. "Who says I've kissed him?" Pauline replied mischievously. We both laughed. Girls of the royal staff were not supposed to indulge in such unrestrained behaviors. "Well, if you were to kiss him, what do you think it would be like?"
"Oh, I think it would taste sweeter than honey."
She fanned herself as if a memory was making her lightheaded.
"Yes, I think it would be very, very good. That is, if I were to kiss him."
I sighed.
"What's the sigh for? You know all about a kiss, Leah. You've kissed half the boys in the village."
I rolled my eyes. "When I was 13, Pauline. That hardly counts. And it was only part of a game. As soon as they realized the danger of kissing the king's daughter, no boy would come near me again. I've had a very long dry period.
What about Charles? Just last summer, his head was constantly turned in your direction. He couldn't keep his eyes off you.
I shook my head. Only moon eyes. When I cornered him at the last harvest celebration, he scampered away like a frightened rabbit. Apparently, he'd received the warning from his parents as well.
Well, you are a dangerous person, you know, she teased.
I very well could be, I answered and patted the dagger hidden beneath my jerkin. She chuckled.
Charles was probably just as afraid of you leading him into another revolt as he was of a stolen kiss. I had almost forgotten my short-lived rebellion. It had been so quickly quashed.
When the Chancellor and Royal Scholar decided all students of Civica would engage in an extra hour each day studying selections from the Holy Text, I led a rebellion. We already spent an hour twice a week memorizing endless disconnected passages that meant nothing to us. An additional hour every day, by my way of thinking, was out of the question. At 14, I had better things to do, and as it turned out, many others afflicted with this new dictum agreed with me. I had followers. I led a revolt, charging with all of them in tow behind me into the Grand Hall, interrupting a cabinet meeting that was in progress that included all the lords of the counties. I demanded that the decision be reversed or we'd quit our studies altogether. Or, I threatened, perhaps we would do something even worse. My father and the vice-regent were amused for all of 2 minutes, but the Chancellor and Royal Scholar were instantly livid. I locked eyes with them, smiling as they seethed. When the amusement faded from my father's face, I was ordered to my chamber for a month, and the students who followed me were given similar but lesser sentences. My little insurrection died, and the dictum stood. But my brazen act was whispered about for months. Some called me fearless, others foolish. Either way, from that day forward, many in my father's cabinet regarded me with suspicion, and that made my month of confinement more than worth it. It was about that time that the reins on my life were drawn in even tighter. My mother spent many more hours schooling me on royal manners and protocol.
Poor Charles. Would your father really have done anything about a mere kiss?
I shrugged. I didn't know. But the perception that he would was enough to keep every boy at a safe distance.
Don't worry. Your time will come, Pauline assured me.
Yes, it would.
I smiled.
I was controlling my destiny now, not a piece of paper that matched me with a royal wrinkle. I was free from all of that at last. I picked up my pace, swinging the basket of cheese in my hand. This time my sigh was warm with satisfaction. I was never more certain of my decision to flee. We finished our walk back to the inn in silence, each of us wrapped up in our thoughts, as comfortable with the quiet between us as we were the chatter. I was caught by surprise to hear the distant holy remembrances at mid-morning. But perhaps in Taravan, traditions were different. Pauline was so consumed in her own thoughts, she didn't seem to hear it at all.
I will find you in the farthest corner. I will find you.
At our insistence, Bertie finally gave us responsibilities beyond errands. I worked hard, not wishing to prove myself a useless royal with no practical skills, though in truth, I had few in the kitchen. At the Citadel, I was barely allowed near the pantry, much less permitted to wield a knife against a vegetable. I had never chopped an onion in my life, but I figured with my skill and accuracy with a dagger, my gouged chamber door as evidence, I could master such a simple task. I was wrong. At least no one mocked me when my slick white onion was catapulted across the kitchen and into Bertie's backside. She matter-of-factly picked it up from the floor, swished it in a tub of water to wash off the dirt, and threw it back to me. I was able to catch and hold the slimy bugger in one hand, eliciting a subtle nod from Bertie, which brought me more satisfaction than I let anyone know. The inn wasn't overflowing with frills to be tended to, but from chopping vegetables, we graduated to tending the guest rooms. There were only 6 rooms at the inn, not counting our leaky cottage and the guest bathhouse. In the mornings, Pauline and I swept the vacated rooms clean, turned the thin mattresses, left new folded sheets on the bedside tables, and finally placed fresh sprigs of tansy on the windowsills and mattresses to deter the vermin that might want to stay at the inn too, especially the freeloaders who came with travelers. The rooms were simple but cheerful, and the scent of the tansy welcoming. But since only a few rooms were vacated each day, our work there took only minutes. One day Pauline marveled at how zealously I attacked my chores. "They should have put you to work at the Citadel. There were a lot of floors to sweep." How I wished I had been given that choice. I had longed for them to believe I had some other worth than sitting through endless lessons they supposed suitable to a royal daughter. My required attempts at lace-making had always resulted in haphazard knots not fit for a fishing net, and my Aunt Cloris accused me of deliberately not paying attention. It exasperated her even more that I didn't deny it. In truth, it was an art I might have appreciated, except for the way it was forced upon me. It was as if no one noticed my strengths or interests. I was a piece of cheese being shoved into a mold. A fleeting compromise needled me. I remembered that my mother had taken note of my aptitude for language and let me tutor my brothers and some of the younger cadets on the Morrigan dialects, some of them so obscure that they were almost different tongues from that spoken at Civica. But even that small concession was put to an end by the royal scholar after I corrected him one day on tense in the Sienese dialect of the High Country. He informed my mother that he and his assistants were better qualified to assign such duties. Perhaps here at the inn, Bertie would appreciate my abilities with her far-flung travelers who spoke different languages. While I acquired the skill of sweeping easily enough, other chores proved more challenging. I had seen maids at the Citadel turning the washing drums with as little as one hand. I thought it to be an easy task. The first time I tried, I spun the drum and ended up with a face full of dirty soapy water because I'd forgotten to secure the latch. Pauline did her best to suppress her laughter. Putting the laundry up to dry didn't prove any easier than washing it. After hanging a whole basket of sheets and standing back to admire my work, a stiff wind came along and sprang them all loose, sending my wooden pegs flying in different directions like mad grasshoppers. Each day's chores brought new aches to new places, shoulders, calves, and even my hands, which were unaccustomed to wringing, twisting, and pounding. A simple small-town life wasn't as simple as I thought, but I was determined to master it. One thing court life had taught me was endurance. Evenings were the busiest, the tavern filled with townsfolk, fishermen, and guests of the inn eager to close out the day with friends. They came for brew, shared laughter, and an occasional snarl of words that Bertie stepped in and settled roundly. Mostly they came for a simple but good hot meal. Summer's arrival meant more travelers, and with the annual Festival of Deliverance quickly approaching, the town would swell to twice its usual size. At Gwyneth's insistence, Bertie finally conceded that extra help was needed in the dining room. On our first night, Pauline and I were each given one table only to tend, while Gwyneth managed more than a dozen. She was something to behold. I guessed she was only a handful of years older than us, but she commanded the dining room like a well-seasoned veteran. She flirted with the young men, winking and laughing, then rolled her eyes when she turned to us. For well-dressed men who were a bit older, ones she was sure had more in their purse to lavish on her, her attentions were more earnest, but ultimately there were none she really took seriously. She was only there to do her job, and she did it well. She sized up the customers quickly, as soon as they walked through the door. It was a diversion for her, and she happily drew us into her game. "That one," she would whisper as a squat man walked through the door. "A butcher, if I've ever seen one. They all have mustaches, you know, and ample guts from eating well. But the hands always tell it all. Butcher's hands are like ham hocks, but meticulously groomed, neat, squared nails." And then, more wistfully, "Lonely types, but generous." She grunted, like she was satisfied that she had summed him up in seconds. "Probably on his way to buy a pig. He'll order a lager, nothing more." When he did indeed order a lone lager, Pauline and I burst into giggles. I knew there was much we could learn from Gwyneth. I studied her movements, her chatter with the customers, and her smile carefully. And of course, I studied the way she flirted.
The old men shall dream dreams. The young maids will see visions. The beast of the forest will turn away. They will see the child of misery coming and make clear the path. Song of Venda. Chapter 7. The Assassin.
I wasn't sure whether to admire her or plan a slower, more painful death for the royal renegade. Strangling her with my bare hands might be best. Or maybe it would serve justice even better to toy with her and make her squirm first. I had little patience for the self-absorbed leeches who supposed their blue blood entitled them to special favor. And she had zero favor with me now. Because of her, I had eaten more road dust and backtracked more miles than I'd ever admit to my comrades. I should have been gone already, on my way with the deed done, but that was ultimately my own shortcoming. I had underestimated her. In her escape, she proved to be more calculating than panicked, leading witnesses to believe she was headed north instead of south, and then she continued to leave deceptive leads. But farmers who imbibe tend to have loose lips and a penchant for bragging on good trades. Now I was following my last lead, a sighting of two people passing down the main street of Terevin with three donkeys, though the riders' genders were unknown, and they were described as filthy beggars. For her own sake, I hoped our clever princess hadn't done more trading. "Ho there!" I called to a mop-haired boy leading a horse to a barn. "The brew here decent?" The boy stopped, like he had to think about it, brushing the hair from his eyes. "Yeah, it's decent. So I hear." He turned to leave. "What about the food?" He stopped again, as though every answer required thought, or perhaps he simply wasn't eager to unsaddle and brush down his charge. "The chowder's the best." "Many thanks." I swung down from my horse. "I wonder, are there mules or donkeys anywhere in town for hire? I need a few to carry some supplies up into the hills." His eyes brightened. "We have three. They belong to one of the workers here." "You think he'd let them out for hire?" "She," he corrected. "And I don't see why not. She's only taken them for short rides to town since she got here a few weeks ago. You can check inside with her. She's serving tables." I smiled. At last. "Thank you again. You've been very helpful." I threw him a coin for his trouble, and watched his countenance change. I'd made a trusted friend. No suspicion would be tossed in my direction. The boy went on his way, and I walked my horse to the far side of the inn, where there were hitching posts for tavern customers. After all the dusty miles I had covered, I'd had a lot of time to wonder about this girl I was finally about to encounter. Was she so afraid of marriage that fleeing into the unknown seemed a better prospect? What did she look like? I didn't have a description beyond her age, and that she was rumored to have long, dark hair, but I figured a royal wouldn't be hard to spot. She was only 17, just a couple of years younger than myself, but a lifetime away in the lives we'd lived. Still, a royal serving tables? The girl was full of surprises. It was unfortunate for her that, by virtue of her birth, she presented a threat to Venda. But mostly I wondered if she truly had the gift. Had she seen me coming? I tied my horse to the last post with a jerk knot, giving him a wide berth from the other horses, and spotted a fellow priming a pump and dunking his head under the flow of water. Not a bad idea before I ventured inside, and if I could buy him a drink, so much the better. Solitary travelers always drew more attention.
Chapter 8. The Prince.
A wedding kava. It took only a little inquiry and a few coins to pry the information from the stable boy's lips. He was the sly sort, knowing her secret might prove of worth to him. I threw him a few more coins and a stern warning that the words would never pass his lips again. The secret was to remain ours alone. After a slow perusal of the sheathed sword hanging from my saddle, he seemed at least bright enough to know I wasn't one to be crossed. He couldn't describe the kava, but he had seen the girl furiously trying to scrub it from her back. Furious. How well I knew the feeling. I was no longer amused or curious. 3 weeks of sleeping on hard, rocky ground had taken care of that. It seemed for days I was always just missing her, only a step behind, then losing the trail entirely, before finding it over and over again, almost as if she was playing a game with me. From the vagabonds who had found her wedding cloak and were patching together their tent with it, to merchants in the city with jewels to trade, to cold campfires off rarely used trails, to a filthy torn gown made from fine lace woven only in Civica, to the hoof prints left on muddy banks, I had followed the meager crumbs she left me, becoming obsessed with not letting her win at the game Sven had spent too many years training me for. I didn't like being played with by a 17-year-old runaway, or maybe I was just taking it too personally. She was throwing in my face just how much she wanted to get away from me. It made me wonder if I would have been as clever or as determined if I had actually acted on my thoughts the way she did. I felt beneath my vest for the only communique I had from her, one filled with so much gall I still had a hard time imagining the girl who wrote it. Inspect me. We'd see who did the inspecting now. I dunked my head beneath the flow of cold water again, trying to cool off in more ways than one. What I really needed was a good long bath.
Save some of that for me, friend.
I whipped my head up, shaking the drops from my hair. A fellow about my age approached, his face as streaked as mine with hard days on the road. Plenty for all? Long journey? Long enough, he answered, plunging his head beneath the water after he had pumped a steady stream. He scrubbed his face and neck with his hands and stood, offering his wet hand. I tried to size him up. He certainly seemed friendly enough, but something about him made me wary, too. And then, as his eyes glanced at my belt and weapon at my side, I knew he was just as carefully sizing me up, the kind of scrutiny a trained soldier might employ, but with the